Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest is Martin Porter. He is co-author of a brand new book called Buzz Me In, Inside the Record Plant Studios. It's a history of this studio that started in New York City, expanded to Los Angeles and Sausalito, and this covers the origin of what was happening in New York City right before they decided that the marketplace needed a place like the Record Plant. So how they started it, how it expanded, how they struggled to keep it going, the ups and downs, and all of the crazy stories of all the artists that recorded there. There's hundreds and hundreds of records, you know, recorded there, and it's just amazing, the who's who of rock and roll who recorded there. So pretty interesting book. If you are interested, check out their website, recordplantdiaries.com. There's all kinds of information there, sample chapters, photos, etc., all kinds of stories. Here it is, me and my chat with Martin Porter. All right, Martin Porter, welcome to the program. How are you?
I am great. I'm great. Great to talk to you.
As I've been saying, I really enjoyed the book, Buzz Me In, Inside the Record Plant Studios. And I've got this hot take that I'm coming in with, so I want your comments. Here it is. I started reading this book and incredibly thoroughly researched, compelling history of this very active place that's a huge part of rock history. And in a nutshell, there were these two guys who sort of sensed a vacuum in the marketplace, which they filled, and all these characters come and work there and come and record there. And about halfway through, the whole thing sort of started to change for me, and it started to feel, to me anyway, that the takeaway is that this is a book about drugs, basically, sort of hedonism and this whole sort of 70s, 80s attitude, but really a lot of drugs. And the same guys who were sort of the heroes of the story come off like they would sort of do anything to keep Record Plant functioning. They, you know, including drugs, including overbilling or padding or lying or, you know, whatever they had to do. And, you know, it's funny because in the 70s and 80s, I think the idea of rock and roll and drugs has been reduced to this kind of funny idea. But here it's kind of very stark and taken in the whole. I really see the whole book as like a drug nightmare. So what's your reaction to that?
I think that it was part of the culture. I think that, you know, listen, there was a lot of damage done. There were lives lost. There's no question about that. That's history. But to put it in perspective, in the record printer perspective, it was a consumable, very much like tape, very much like, you know, like it was part of the scene. It was an early period by the mid-70s, or early 70s, essentially, that people weren't quite sure of the damage that was... Cocaine was a big part of the scene, obviously. There were mirrors on the consoles. There were dealers who had open access to the studios. And it was up to the studio owners to provide the creative environment that the artists wanted. Drugs were very much part of it. And for us to pretend otherwise is silly. And I don't think anybody would ever say that it was fun and games. There was some of it was ignorance. Some of it was lubricating the process. Some of it was putting up with the sheer pressure of having to put out hits. You can't underestimate what the pressure of making a record and what that does to an artist, and what that does in a highly compressed, highly pressured environment like a recording studio, where you the hit is everything, getting a sound is everything. Artists live under very unique conditions, and the Record Plant satisfied the needs of those artists any way they wanted. There were bedrooms, there were drugs. There was the greatest audio that you could possibly obtain. Yes, it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll and audio. So, you know, did it get dark? Yes. You know, listen, the two gentlemen, Chris Stone and Gary Kellgren, Gary Kellgren died, drowned. He was a victim of the drug scene. 77, he died in his swimming pool. So I don't think that you can say the Record Plant didn't get dark. It certainly got dark. You have Phil Spector wielding guns around, you know, under drug raid. But I also think that was one other thing to consider. Not only was it a creative environment, and the story we tell, I look at it, is what does it take to create for somebody to manage and maintain and invent a creative environment where consistently hits were made? And yes, drugs were part of it, but it was only one part of it. And I think you can overread that from the distance of 50 years.
Well, I applaud you for not shying away from that, because like you said, there's no way to tell this story without that component. So let's go back to what I said about how the guys filled a niche in the marketplace. What was that vacuum that they filled?
Well, it's a long time ago, and you have to sort of transport yourself to a period when the recording process was expensive. You couldn't just flip up your laptop or turn on your phone. You need union-trained engineers, and the only organizations, by and large, that can afford that were either hobbyists or on the professional level, record labels. And as the music changed in the late 60s, the recording process changed. And Gary Kellgren, one of the founders, and Chris Stone, his partner, filled the vacuum. And the vacuum was that the artists wanted freedom, they wanted privacy, they wanted security, they wanted to get the hell away from the union engineers, and they wanted to stick and make sure the label executives kept their distance. So Gary Kellgren took what was a laboratory, environment of a recording studio, and for Jimi Hendrix, created a living room. And the concept was of a living room studio was for it to be comfortable, where the artist could be safe, secure, private, and could experiment and jam. And that was very unique, and that was Gary Kellgren's vision. And that's what made the record plant great.
Yeah, it is funny how that idea of like a dark, comfortable place was not the norm until studios like this started to come along. So a lot of the book comes from Chris's stuff he left behind, his archives. There's also interviews with 120 employees and producers and artists who worked there. Did some people you talked to want to be quoted anonymously, or were they hesitant to share stories? Because there is some law-breaking activity that goes on here. Obviously, it's 50 years ago in a lot of cases, but were people hesitant?
Yeah, there were people who were hesitant, but I also think as people age, they put it in a different perspective. It was a private place, and keeping privacy was part of the whole story. Record Plant Studios were the only place where the artists could lock the control room door so nobody could get in. You had to get buzzed into the studio. Remember that. That buzz me in was the key word in L.A. to get you in the studio. So there was certainly the privacy thing was a big part of it. But as people got older and as people passed away and as people started seeing that a lot of their friends were not around much anymore, they opened up and realized, these stories had to be told. And yes, there was illegal activity taking place, and in certain parts it got pretty dark, but the stories needed to be told. And there was a little bit of more security with age and people passing and time, of course.
And I think maybe as people get older, they think about their legacy and wanting to sort of cement that, and this book does a great job. Let me remind folks that Martin Porter is our guest. He's the co-author of Buzz Me In, Inside the Record Plant Studios. And interesting website, recordplantdiaries.com, has got lots of information and excerpts and, of course, a place to get the book at all. I do think that the ethics of running the studio and that Chris and Gary's mania to keep the studio afloat no matter what did provide some times where there were some slippery ethics. And I think like one example is when they installed a hot tub or a pinball machine, they realized that these things would distract the bands from doing actual recording. So they're still paying whatever hundreds of dollars per hour to record, but they're wasting that time playing pinball. And they sort of saw those, or like selling lots of tape to folks, or to make, to backing up things, or, record things twice. They also seem to cover up the circumstances of a death that stemmed from nitrous oxide. And at one point, this is to me the absolute top of this bubble of that they had nitrous oxide as something you could sort of plug in at the mixing desk. You mentioned earlier there were mirrors built into the design of the desk. Eventually they added nitrous oxide. That is really, really crazy. And it almost seems like they're divorced from reality at a certain point.
Well, I think there is some sense of, we've all seen it in the movies, we've seen it in culture. Success, money breeds mania, and especially when you're living in a private little box with locked doors that nobody can come into. That creates its own Hotel California environment that I think a lot of people feel that this space influenced. I talked about the pressure of making a recording. Imagine doing it in behind the locked doors for days and months at a time. It can drive you a little nuts. There's no question about it. Running the business has had its own share of highs and lows. And these guys were making tons of money, and they were making tons of money by servicing the artists. And, you know, let me talk about the ethical part. They did run a lot of tape. They did build artists for a time where they were being recreational activities as opposed to recording. But you can't separate that experience from the success of the music. There was something magical happening there, guys, and you can focus on the darkness and the partying and the craziness, but whatever happened, it succeeded. All right? Look at the result. And I'm not rationalizing it, and I'm not excusing anything, and I'm sure things were done that were less than ethical. You can't take away the success of whatever they did, and that's its legacy.
Yeah, in 1976 alone, Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life, Eagles, Hotel California, and Fleetwood Mac, Rumors, all number one, all recorded there. They were sort of dominating, and all of those were on the, you know, on the charts for weeks and for years, really, not even weeks. So let's talk about something happier. Stevie Wonder, when he sort of gets out of his first Motown contract and re-signs with them, and he has complete independence to do what he wants. And I think he kind of wants to mentally and physically get away from the Motown studios. And he kind of ensconces himself in Record Plant for years and years and years and makes what is, you know, undisputably his most mind-blowing and popular music there. I mean, the amount of music he made, and it seems like there's tons of unreleased stuff from what's in the book. It's just an incredible legacy for the Record Plant.
Yeah, Studio B, Record Plant, Los Angeles, I will maintain maybe the most successful recording studio in history. Now, people from Studio B, Record Plant, LA, where the hell is that? Well, it was a small, unspectacular room that Chris and Gary rented for an entire year, and then for 4 years, to Stevie Wonder and his two producers, and they built Studio B as a quadraphonic room. Back then, quad was just coming in. It's immersive sound. It was the early days of immersive sound. It never took off. But they built a room that had the magic mojo. You could not do anything wrong in there. And Stevie owned that room, housed that room, and produced with that team over 4 years some of the greatest music in history. A Talking Book, Inner Visions, Fulfillingness in the last finale, Songs in the Key of Life, and over 300 songs recorded by Stevie Wonder and that team during that period, and were housed in the archive there, and many still have not been released. So there's a massive trove of music that Stevie and those guys produced in quad, by the way. It could be released today in immersive sound if they ever did it. So it would be an amazing experience to hear some of that stuff.
That really sort of got me drooling, that part of the book about the unreleased Stevie Wonder stuff. I can see why artists, from what you've mentioned, loved to be in all these spaces, but can you put your finger on exactly what it was technically that producers liked? Was it just that the guys made a real effort to keep everything state-of-the-art?
Well, you had to be first. Remember, that was always the key. It was a technology warfare at that time between studios. Whoever had the best tech got first. The reason why Jimi Hendrix was drawn to Gary Kelvin's first studio, because it was the first with a 12-track studio, 12 tracks. They learned quick if they could find the latest gear, the coolest outboard gear, the coolest, best-sounding consoles, the most tracks, and the best-sounding monitors, they'd get the artists. And like I said, you know, we talk a lot about drugs in this book, yeah, but I'm telling you, the big drug for any musician, I don't care what they love. They love audio the best. Kellgren, with the help of a guy named Tom Hidley, built this control room. And this control room design was revolutionary because it created an environment where the artists could play back their music and hear their music way they could never hear it anywhere else. The monitors were the best. The acoustics were the best in that control room.
Everything wasn't just heavy there. There was, I think this was mostly a New York thing, sort of a culture of pranks, I guess, to let off the steam.
Well, listen, you know, New York, they say, you know, New York was a sitcom. And we've talked a lot about Gary and Chris. There was really a third character in this story, and it's a guy named Roy Sakala. All right? And let me, all the pranks really start with Roy. Roy Sakala, when Chris and Gary sold the studio and moved out to L.A. and opened L.A. in Sausalito, New York needed somebody to run it. They found a guy named Roy Sakala, who was a great engineer. And to a great extent, New York became Roy Sakala's studio. He was John Lennon's engineer and did all of John's post-Beatles work at Record Plant. And he had his own culture. And the culture, Roy liked to have fun. And he discovered this the fire extinguisher on the wall one day. He saw an engineer falling asleep in session, took this off the wall and just sprayed the shit out of him. And it started a generation of fire extinguisher wars that took place. There was gaffer's tape around. They would gaffer tape an engineer and put him in the garbage. He did crazy stuff. And it's almost a sitcom. It really was a bit of a sitcom in New York. And, you know, again, I talk about the studio being a bit of a pressure cooker. Letting off the steamer is vital when you have a pressure cooker, and having fun is part of that.
There's a lot of photos in the book as well. I was just looking through the photos, and it's incredible how skinny everybody is. And it's funny because food is not mentioned that often in the book. Sometimes there's kind of power lunches, but it's a lot of skinny guys who seem to be working, you know, 24 hours a day. I think one of the things is the book, you know, is just a little bit of a time capsule for the history of what was happening culturally. You know, it just happens to choose the music industry portion of the world to reflect that. But that really does reflect society in general. And there was just so much money at this time being generated by LP sales were just, you know, going crazy. And this money is just driving all of this. It's a super fascinating story. It's called Buzz Me In Inside the Record Plant Studios. I saw on your website that you guys put up some Spotify playlists that reflect music worked on at Record Plant Studios. And there's lots of incredible stuff that folks can, and so surprising, like you just never know. Like, there, you know, there's so much. We're talking about the hits, but there's just a ton. Of great music. So New York, I think, closed in 87. L.A. studio changed hands a million times. The Sausalito studio is still going. Well, sort of what put an end to the run of the Record Plant?
Technology. It's sort of the way technology eats itself. You know, as I said, these were the early tech bros. You know, if you were a kid and liked technology back in the late 60s, early 70s, you went into audio. Today you go into AI and you go into social media and you go into the computer and so on, right? But cybersecurity. But then it was audio, you know. And that technology evolved. Digital came in, brought in a whole new form of sound effects and ability ways to treat the music. The tracks grew. They went to CDs. Vinyl went to CDs. Went to streaming. And today you can have unlimited tracks on and make an album on a laptop. Give me a laptop. Give a great musician a laptop and a microphone. You can make a record. Those days it was different, and the economics changed. You know, certainly streaming changed the economics of the business. But if you go back in time, and you know, I don't know how many of your readers will remember it, but it was first came hi-fi. Hi-fi became a huge business. Stereo music. Everybody needed a stereo. You had to feed those stereos. If I went out to my stereo store and bought a Therenz turntable, if I could afford it, a Marantz and Pioneer and all those brands of long gone audio, I needed to feed it with vinyl. And it became, that's what the business was about. And now, you know, now it's about feeding the stream and the economics needs, and you know, economics changed. But to build the first record plant cost $100,000 in 1968. You know, tape machines were $40,000. You know, consoles were in those days $100,000, and over the years became multi-million-dollar objects. You know, you can't. That's not sustainable as a business model. Although for an exclusive, very high-end customer who loves analog, there is still a remaining demand. Not huge, like there is demand for vinyl. It's niche. And there are still some great studios. And Record Plant LA, like you said, closed in a new location last year, a victim of the times. But there is a resurgence of Sausalito. And Sausalito was Gary Kelgren's great, it's his masterpiece, studio masterpiece. And there's a new group of people who were bringing it back to life on by the bay in Sausalito. It was just there for book signing. It was great to see these guys being successful and have some money behind them. It takes money. But, you know, it's sort of like having a ball club, having a big studio, right? It becomes a rich man's passion. And thank God for them because they're saving it.
Once again, the name of the book is Buzz Me In, Inside the Record Plant Studios. There's a Facebook page, and there is the website, recordplantdiaries.com. Martin Porter, thank you so much for joining me. I really enjoyed the book. I felt, if you're interested, you know, there's just because the number of people who cross paths with the Record Plant is, like you said, it's almost infinite. Then you've heard of all of them, and there's all sorts of new stories and outrageous stories, and it's super interesting. Thanks so much, and best of luck with the book.
Well, thank you so much, too. And thanks for spreading the word.